To deactivate it, he pressed all three numbers in the correct order. The code was changed every morning, and of the two men crewing the truck, only the driver knew it. There were 1,000 possible three-number sequences in 10 digits. Because it would take between 4 and 5 seconds to key in each sequence and wait for it to be accepted or rejected, they would have to delay at least an hour and a quarter to try every combination. That was far too risky. Chad Zepp removed the faceplate from the lock. The 10-numbered buttons remained, but now it was possible to see a bit of the mechanism between and behind them. Hung on a strap from Zepp's shoulder was a battery-powered, attaché-sized computer, which could assess and control the circuitry of electronic locks and alarms. It was SLICS, an acronym for Security Lock Intervention and Circumvention Knowledge System. Intended solely for military or intelligence agency personnel with security clearance, SLICS was unavailable to the public. Unauthorized possession was a criminal violation of the Defense Security Act. To obtain a SLICS, Jack had gone to Mexico City and had paid $25,000 to a black market arms dealer who had a contact inside the firm that manufactured the device. Zepp unslung the computer and held it so he and Jack and Pollard could see the 4-inch square video display, which was dark. 3 retractable probes were slotted in the SLICS, and Jack withdrew the first of these from its niche. It looked like a copper-tipped steel thermometer on a 2-foot wire umbilical. Jack looked closely at the partially exposed guts of the electronic lock and carefully inserted the slender probe between the first 2 buttons, touching it to the contact point at the base of the button marked 1. The display screen remained dark. He moved the probe to button number 2, then 3. Nothing. But when he touched number 4, a pale green word, current, appeared on the screen, plus numbers that measured trace electricity in the contact. This meant that the middle number of the 3-digit lock code was 4. After loading sacks of money and checks into the cargo hold at the last stop on the route, the driver had pushed 4 to activate the lock. The contact point of that button would remain closed until the entire code was punched in, thereby unlocking the door. With 3 unknown numbers, the possible combinations had been 1,000. But now that they needed to find only the first and last numbers, the search was reduced to 100 combinations. Ignoring the howling wind, Jack withdrew another instrument from the SLICS. This was also on a 2-foot cord, but resembled a watercolor brush, but with a single bristle. The bristle glowed with light and was thicker than a 60-pound fishing line, stiff yet flexible. Jack inserted it into a crack at the base of the 1 button on the lock keyboard, glanced at the computer video display, but was not rewarded. He moved the bristle probe from number to number. The display screen blinked, then showed a partial diagram of a circuit board. The bristle that he had thrust inside the mechanism was actually the end filament of an optical laser, a more sophisticated cousin of the similar device which, in supermarket cash registers, read the barcodes on grocery items. The SLICS was not programmed to read barcodes, but to recognize circuitry patterns and render models of them on the display screen. The screen would register nothing whatsoever until the bristle probe was aimed directly at a circuit or portion thereof, but then it would faithfully reproduce the hidden pattern that it saw. Jack had to move the probe 3 times, insert it into the lock mechanism at 3 different points, before the computer was able to piece together a picture of the entire circuitry from partial views. The diagram glowed in bright green lines and symbols on the miniature video display. After 3 seconds of consideration, the computer drew boxes around 2 small portions of the diagram to indicate those points at which a tap could easily be applied to the circuitry. Then it superimposed an image of the 10-digit keyboard over the diagram to show where those 2 weak points were in relation to that portion of the lock mechanism that was visible to Jack. There's a good tap-in spot below the number 4 button, Jack said.
You need me to drill? Pollard asked.
I don't think so. Jack returned the optical probe to its slot and withdrew a third slender instrument with a spongy mesh tip of some material he could not identify, which the designer of Slicks had labeled the tap wand. He inserted it through the tiny gap in the lock mechanism at the base of the 4 button, slowly moved it up and down, left and right, until the computer beeped and flashed intervention on the miniature video display. While Jack held the tap wand in place, and Chad Zepp held the Slicks upright, Pollard used the computer's small programming board to quickly type instructions. Intervention disappeared, and onto the screen came other words. System control established. The computer could now feed commands directly to the microchip that processed the lock codes and that directed the sliding steel bolts to either close or open. Pollard hit two more keys, and the Slicks began to send sequences of 3 numbers to the microchip, 1 combination every 600ths of a second, all of which used the already known 4 as the middle digit of the code. Slicks hit the right code, 545, in only 9 seconds. With 4 simultaneous thumps, the lock bolts retracted as 1. Jack returned the tap wand to its niche, switched off the computer. Only 4 minutes had passed since the rifle shot that had blown out the truck's right front tire. Clockwork. As Zepp slung the Slicks over his shoulder again, Pollard opened the rear doors of the armored car. The money was theirs for the taking. Zepp laughed with delight. With a gleeful whoop, Pollard clambered into the truck and began to push out bulging canvas bags. But Jack still felt empty and cold inside. A few snow flurries suddenly appeared in the wind. The unexplained change in Jack, which had begun weeks ago, had now reached completion. He no longer cared about getting even with society. He felt purposeless, as adrift as the wind-borne flakes of snow.
Elko County, Nevada. Fay Block had turned on the no-vacancy notice to ensure that they would not be disturbed. Sitting around the table in the cheery kitchen of their apartment above the motel office, with the blinds shut against the night, the Blocks sipped coffee and listened spellbound as Dom told his story. The only point at which they registered disbelief was when he told them of the impossible dance of paper moons in Zebediah Lomax's house in Reno. But he was able to describe that startling event in such sharp detail that he felt goose flesh pimpling his arms, and he saw that his own awe and fear were being transmitted to Fay and Ernie. They appeared most impressed by the 2 Polaroid photographs that had arrived in the mail from the unknown correspondent 2 days before Dom had flown to Portland. They studied the picture in which the zombie-faced priest was sitting at a writing desk, and they were certain it had been taken in one of their motel rooms. The photo of the blonde in bed with an IV line in her arm was a close-up that showed nothing of the room, but they recognized the floral-patterned bedspread visible in one corner of the shot. It was the kind that had been in use in some units until 10 months ago. To Dom's surprise, they had been sent a similar photograph. Ernie remembered receiving it in a plain envelope on December 10th, 5 days before they had flown to Milwaukee. Fay got it from the center drawer of the desk in the downstairs office, and they hunched conspiratorially over the kitchen table, studying the print. It was a shot of 3 people, man, woman, child, standing in sunshine by the door to room 9. All 3 were dressed in shorts, t-shirts, and sandals.
"Do you recognize them?" Dom asked.
"No," Fay said.
"But I feel like I ought to remember them," Ernie said.
Dom said, "Sunshine, summer clothes, so we can almost certainly conclude it was taken the summer before last, that weekend, between Friday, the 6th of July, and the following Tuesday. These 3 people were part of whatever happened, maybe innocent victims like us, and our unknown correspondent wants us to think about them."
remember them.
Ernie said,
Whoever sent the pictures would have been one of the people who erased our memories. So why would he want to stir us up like this after so much trouble was taken to make us forget?
Dom shrugged.
Maybe he never believed it was right, what was done to us. Maybe he only went along with it because he had to. And maybe it's been on his conscience ever since. Whoever he is, he's afraid to come right out with what he knows. He's got to do it indirectly.
Abruptly, Faye pushed her chair back from the table. 5 weeks of mail piled up while we were away. Might be something more in it. As the sound of Faye's descending footsteps echoed up from the stairs, Ernie said,
Sandy, as our waitress at the grill, sorted through the mail and paid the bills as they arrived, but the rest of the mail she just dropped in a paper sack. Since we came back this morning, we've been so busy getting the place open, we didn't bother looking to see what the postman brought.
Faye returned with two plain white envelopes. In a state of high excitement, they opened the first. It contained a Polaroid of a man lying on his back in bed, an intravenous needle in his arm. He was in his 50s, dark hair, balding. In ordinary circumstances, he probably had a jovial look, for he resembled W.C. Fields. But he was staring blankly toward the camera, face bleak, zombie eyes.
My God! It's Calvin, Faye said.
Yeah, Ernie said. Cal Sharkle. He's a long-haul chucker moving freight between Chicago and San Francisco.
He stops at the grill most every trip, Faye said. Sometimes when he's beat, he stays overnight. Calvin's such a nice man.
What companies he drive for? Dom asked. He's independent, Ernie said. Owns his own rig. Would you know how to get in touch with him?
Well, Ernie said. He signs the registry every time he checks in, so we'll have his address. Around Chicago, somewhere, I think.
We'll check later. First, let's look in that other envelope. Faye opened it and produced another Polaroid. Again, it was a shot of a man lying in one of the Tranquility Motel's beds, an IV line in one arm. Like all the others, he had no expression whatsoever, and soulless eyes that reminded Dom of horror movies about the living dead. But this time they all recognized the man in the bed. It was Dom. Las Vegas, Nevada. When Marcy's bedtime came, she was sitting at the little desk in the corner of her room, occupied with her collection of moons. Georgia stood in the doorway watching. The girl was so thoroughly engaged by the task that she remained unaware she was being observed. A box of crayons lay beside the album full of moons. Marcy was hunched over the work surface, carefully coloring one of the lunar faces. This was a new development, and Georgia wondered what it meant. In the week since Marcy had begun her collection with magazine clippings, she had filled the album. She had few sources for photos, so she drew hundreds of pictures to add to the monotonous gallery. Using templates as varied as coins, jar lids, vases, drinking glasses, cans, and thimbles, she traced lunar forms of all sizes on tablet paper, construction paper, paper bags, envelopes, and wrapping paper. She did not spend most of her time with the album, but each day she devoted a bit more time to it than she had the day before. Dr. Ted Coverley, the psychologist treating Marcy, believed the anxiety that had generated the girl's irrational fear of doctors had not been relieved. Now the child was expressing that anxiety through her lunar preoccupation. When Georgia noted that Marcy did not seem to be particularly frightened of the moon, Coverley said,
Well, her anxiety doesn't have to seek expression in another phobia. It can show itself in other ways, such as an obsession.
Georgia could not understand where her daughter's extraordinary anxiety came from. Coverley said,
That's why the therapy, to seek understanding.
Don't worry, Miss Monticella. But Georgia was worried. She was worried because Alan had killed himself only yesterday. Georgia had not yet told Marcy of her father's death. On leaving Pepper Carrafield's apartment, she had called Coverley to ask his advice. He was astonished to learn that Alan, too, had been dreaming of the moon and had independently developed an intense lunar fascination of his own. That one would take time to ponder. Meanwhile, Coverly thought it wise to withhold the bad news from Marcy until Monday.
Come with her to the appointment. We'll tell her together.
Georgia was afraid that in spite of Alan's inattention, Marcy would be devastated by his death. As she stood in the bedroom doorway, watching Marcy diligently applying a crayon to one of the moons, Georgia was stricken by an acute awareness of the girl's fragility. Although she was 7 years old and in second grade, the three-quarter scale chair was still too big for her, and only the toes of her sneakers touched the floor. Even for a macho man armored with muscles, life was tenuous, and every additional day of existence was against the odds. But for a child as petite as Marcy, continued life seemed downright miraculous. Georgia realized how easily her precious daughter could be taken from her, and her heart swelled and ached with love. When at last Georgia said,
"Honey, better put your pajamas on and brush your teeth," she could not keep a tremor out of her voice.
The girl looked bewildered, as if she were not quite sure where she was or who Georgia was. Then her eyes cleared, and she gave her mother a smile that could melt butter.
"Hi, Mommy. I've been coloring moons." "Well, now it's time to get ready for bed," Georgia said. "In a little while, okay?"
The girl appeared to be relaxed, yet she was gripping a crayon so tightly that her knuckles were white.
"I want to color some more moons."
Georgia wanted to destroy the hateful album, but Dr. Coverly had warned that arguing with the child about the moons and forbidding her to collect them would only strengthen her obsession. Georgia was not sure he was right, but she stifled the urge to destroy the album.
"Tomorrow you'll have lots of time to color, Peanut."
Reluctantly, Marcy closed the album, put away her crayons, and went to the bathroom to brush her teeth. Alone beside the child's desk, Georgia was overcome by weariness. In addition to working a full shift, she had arranged a mortician for Alan's body, ordered flowers, and settled details with the cemetery for Monday's funeral. She had also called Alan's estranged father in Miami to break the bad news. She was drained. Wearily, she opened the album. Red. The girl was coloring all the moons red, both those she had drawn and those clipped from newspapers and magazines. She had already painted more than 50 lunar images. The obsessive quality of the girl's work was evident in the great care she had taken to keep the crayon from slipping past the outline of each moon. The crayon had been applied more heavily, picture by picture, until some moons were coated with so much scarlet wax that they had a glisteningly wet look. The use of red, and red alone, profoundly disturbed Georgia. It almost seemed as if Marcy had glimpsed an augury of some onrushing terror, a premonition of blood. Elko County, Nevada. Faye Block had gone downstairs to the file cabinets from which she had extracted the motel registry that had been in use the summer before last. Upon her return, she put the book on the kitchen table in front of Dom, open to the guest lists of Friday and Saturday, July 6th and 7th.
"There. Just like Ernie and I remembered. That Friday was the night they closed the interstate because of a toxic spill. A truckload of dangerous chemicals headed out to Schenckfield. That's a military installation about 18 miles southwest of here. We had to close the motel until Tuesday, until they got the situation under control."
Ernie said, "Schenckfield's an isolated testing ground for chemical and biological weapons, so the crap in that truck was damn nasty."
Faye continued, a new wooden note in her voice, as if reciting carefully memorized lines.
"They erected roadblocks and ordered us to evacuate the danger zone. Our guests left in their own cars."
Her face remained expressionless.
"Ned and Sandy Sarver were allowed to go up to their trailer near Beowawe because it was outside the quarantine area."
Astonished and confused, Dom said, "Impossible. I don't remember any evacuation. I was here. I remember reading, researching the geography for a series of short stories. But those memories are so thin, I suspect they aren't real. no substance to them. Still, I was here, and nowhere else, and something weird was done to me.
He indicated the Polaroid snapshot of himself.
There's the proof.
When Faye spoke, she sounded stiffer than before, and Dom saw a strangeness in her eyes, a slightly glazed look.
Until the all-clear was given, Ernie and I stayed with friends who have a small ranch in the mountains 10 miles northeast of here, Elroy and Nancy Jameson. It was a difficult spill to clean up. The Army needed more than 3 days to do the job. They wouldn't let us back here until Tuesday morning.
"What's wrong with you, Faye?" Dom asked.
She blinked.
"Huh? What do you mean?"
"You sound as if you'd been programmed with that little speech." She seemed genuinely baffled.
"What are you talking about?"
Frowning, Ernie said,
"Faye, your voice went flat."
"Well, I was only explaining what happened." She leaned over and put one finger on Friday's page of the registry.
"See? We had rented out 11 rooms by the time they closed the interstate that night. But nobody paid for the rooms because nobody stayed. They were evacuated."
"There's your name. 7th on the list," Ernie said.
Dom stared at his signature and at the Mountain View, Utah address to which he had been moving at the time. He could remember checking in, but he sure as hell could not remember climbing back into his car and driving out the same night in response to an evacuation order. He said,
"Did you actually see the accident? The tanker truck?"
Ernie shook his head.
"No. The truck overturned a couple miles from here."
He spoke in that by rote tone that had marked Faye's speech.
"The Army experts from Schenckfield were concerned the chemicals would be dispersed by the wind, so the quarantine zone was very large."
Chilled by the unconscious artificiality in Ernie's voice, Dom looked at Faye and saw that she too had noticed her husband's unnatural tone. He said,
"That's what you sounded like a moment ago, Faye."
He looked at Ernie. "You two have been programmed with the same script." Faye frowned.
"Are you saying the spill never happened?"
"It happened, all right," Ernie told Dom. "For a while, we saved a bunch of newspaper clippings about it from the Elko Sentinel, but I think we eventually threw them out. Anyway, people around these parts still wonder what might have happened if we'd gotten big winds and been contaminated with that top-secret stuff before the evacuation order was even given. Nah, it's not just some delusion of Faye's and mine."
"You can ask Elroy and Nancy Jameson," Faye said. "They were here that night visiting. When we had to evacuate, they offered to take us back to their place and put us up for the duration."
Dom smiled sourly.
"I wouldn't put much credence in their recall of events. If they were here, then they saw what the rest of us saw, and it was scrubbed from their minds. They remember taking you back to their place because that's what they were told to remember. In fact, they were probably right here, being brainwashed with the rest of us."
"My head's swimming," Faye said. "This is positively Byzantine."
"But damn it, the toxic spill and evacuation happened," Ernie said. "It was in the newspapers."
Dom thought of a disturbing explanation that made his scalp crawl. "What if everyone here at the motel that night was contaminated with some chemical or biological weapon headed for Schenckfield? And what if the Army and the government covered it up to avoid bad press, millions of dollars in lawsuits, and the disclosure of top-secret information? Maybe they closed the highway and announced that everyone was safely evacuated when, in fact, we had not been gotten out in time. Then they used the motel as a clinic, decontaminated us as much as they could, scrubbed the memory of the incident out of our minds, and reprogrammed us with false memories so we'd never know what had happened to us." They stared at one another in shocked silence for a moment. Not because the scenario sounded entirely right, which it did not, but because it was the first scenario they'd come up with that made sense of the psychological problems they had been having and explained the drugged people in those Polaroid snapshots. Then Ernie and Faye began to think of objections. Ernie voiced the first.
In that case, the logical thing for them to have done was to make our false memories tie in closely with their cover story about the toxic spill and evacuation. That's exactly what they did with Faye and me, with the Jamesons, Ned and Sandy Sarver. So why didn't they do the same with you? Why'd they program you with different memories that didn't have anything to do with the evacuation? That was irrational and risky. I mean, the radical differences between our memories is virtually proof that you, or we, or all of us, were brainwashed.
Don't know, Dom said. That's just one more mystery to unravel.
And here's another flaw in that theory, Ernie said. If we'd been contaminated by a biological weapon, they wouldn't have let us go in just 3 days. They'd have been afraid of contagion, epidemic.
Dom said, all right, so it was a chemical agent, not a virus or bacterium, something they could wash off or flush out of our systems.
That doesn't make sense either, Faye said, because the things they test at Schenckfield are meant to be deadly. Poison gas, nerve gas, hideous damn stuff. If we'd got caught in a cloud like that, we'd have been dead on the spot, or brain damaged or crippled.
Maybe it was a slow-acting agent, Dom said. Something that generates tumors, leukemia, or other conditions that only begin to show up 2 or 3 or 5 years from the date of contamination.
That thought also shocked them into silence. They listened to the ticking of the kitchen clock, to the mournful fluting of the wind at the windows, wondering if malignancies were even now sprouting within them. Finally, Ernie said,
maybe we were contaminated, and maybe we're all slowly rotting inside, but I don't think so. After all, they test potential weapons at Schenckfield. And what use would a weapon be that didn't kill the enemy for years and years?
Virtually no use at all, Dom acknowledged.
And how could chemical contamination explain that bizarre experience you had in Lomax's house in Reno?
I have no idea, Dom said. But now that we know they cordoned off this whole area using the excuse of a toxic spill, whether it was a real spill or not, my theory that we were brainwashed is a lot more credible. Because, see, before this, I wasn't able to explain how someone could have rounded us up at will and held us long enough to make us forget the thing we saw. But the quarantine gave them the time they needed, and it also kept away prying eyes, so at least now we have a good idea who we're up against. The United States Army. Maybe acting in collusion with the government, maybe acting alone, has been trying to hide something that happened here. Something it did but shouldn't have done. I don't know about you, but the thought of being up against an enemy that big and that potentially ruthless scares the hell out of me.
An old leatherneck like me is bound to be scornful of the Army, Ernie said. But they're not devils, you know. We can't leap to the conclusion we're victims of a wicked right-wing conspiracy. That crackpot stuff makes millions for paranoid novelists and for Hollywood, but in the real world, evil is more subtle, less identifiable. If Army and government officials are behind what happened to us, they don't necessarily have immoral motives. They probably think they did the only wise thing they could have done in the circumstances.
But whether or not it's wise, Faye said, we've got to dig into this situation. If we don't, Ernie's nyctophobia will surely get worse. And your sleepwalking will also get worse, Dom. And what then?
They all knew what then. What then was a shotgun barrel jammed in the mouth, the route to peace that Zebediah Lomax had taken. Dom looked down at the motel registry on the table before him. 4 spaces above his own name, he saw another entry that electrified him. Dr. Ginger Weiss. Her address was in Boston.
Ginger, he said. The 4th name on those moon posters.
Furthermore, Cal Sharkle, the block's trucker friend from Chicago, the zombie-eyed subject of one of the Polaroid snapshots, had checked into the motel just before Dr. Weiss. The first guests to sign in that day were Mr. and Mrs. Alan Rykoff and daughter of Las Vegas. Dom was willing to bet that they were the young family photographed in front of the door to room 9. Zebediah Lomax's name was not in the registry,
so he had probably just been unlucky enough to stop at the grill for dinner that night, on his way between Reno and Elko. One of the other names might have been that of the young priest in the other Polaroid, but if so, he had signed without appending his title.
"We'll have to talk to all these people," Dom said excitedly. "We can start calling them first thing tomorrow and see what they remember about those days in July."
Chicago, Illinois. By allowing no slightest hairline crack to appear in his resolve, by showing no equivocation whatsoever, Brendan managed to obtain Father Vikosik's permission to go to Nevada alone on Monday, without Monsignor Janney trailing him in expectation of miracles. By 10:10, he was in bed with the lights out, lying on his side in blackness, staring at the window, where the palest light glistered softly in the frost that skinned the pane. The window looked out upon the courtyard, where no lights burned at this hour, so Brendan knew that he was seeing indirect moonglow refracted by the thin layer of ice that had welded itself to the glass. It had to be indirect light, because the moon was traversing the sky on a course that had made it visible from the study windows earlier in the evening, and the study was on the other side of the rectory. The moon could not now be over the courtyard, unless it had made a sudden 90-degree turn in the path it had previously been following, which was not possible. As he patiently lay waiting for sleep, he became increasingly intrigued by the subtle patterns made by the second-hand moonbeams that had been trapped in the frost. Light splintered at every point where one ice crystal interfaced with another, each beam shattering into 100 beams, 100 more.
"The moon," he whispered, surprised by his voice. "The moon." Gradually, Brendan realized that something uncanny was happening. At first he was merely fascinated by the harmonious interaction of frost and moonlight, but soon fascination evolved into a more intense attraction. He could not look away from the pearly window. It offered an indefinable promise, and he was drawn as a sailor by a siren's song. Before he knew what he intended, he had slipped one arm out from beneath the blankets and was reaching toward the window, though it was 10 feet away and could not be touched from where he lay. The black silhouette of his spread-fingered hand was clearly defined against the nivous pane of glass that glowed softly beyond, and his futile straining was the essence of yearning. Brendan longed to be within the light, not the light that lived in the frost, but that other, golden light of his dreams. "The moon," he whispered, again surprised that he had spoken. His heartbeat accelerated. He began to tremble.
Suddenly, upon the glass, the sugary-looking frost underwent an inexplicable change. As Brendan watched, the thin rime melted away from the edges of the pane toward the center. In a few seconds, when the melting stopped, there remained only a perfect circle of ice, about 10 inches in diameter, glowing eerily in the middle of an otherwise clear, dry, dark rectangle of glass. The moon. Brendan knew it was a sign, though he did not know from whom, or what, or where it came, nor did he understand it. On Christmas night, when he had stayed at his parents' house in Bridgeport, Brendan had apparently had a dream featuring the moon, for he had awakened his mother and father with his loud and panicky cries. But he could remember nothing of the dream. Since then, as far as he knew, none of his dreams had involved the moon, but were concerned exclusively with that mysterious place full of dazzling golden light, where he felt himself called toward some incredible revelation. Now, as he still reached with one hand toward the glimmering frost on the window, the vaguely phosphorescent rime grew brighter, as if some peculiar chemical reaction was at work within the ice crystals. The moon image changed from a milky hue to the crisper white of sun-dappled snow, then grew even brighter until it was a scintillant circle of silver blazing on the glass. heart pounding furiously, certain he was teetering on the edge of some astounding epiphany. Brendan continued to hold his hand toward the window, and he gasped in shock as a shaft of light leapt out from the frost moon and fell across the bed. It was like the beam of a spotlight, and every bit as brilliant. As he squinted into the glare, trying to see how such fierce incandescence could possibly originate from ordinary hoarfrost and glass, the light changed to pale red, to darker red, to crimson, to scarlet. Around him, the rumpled blankets shone like molten steel, and his outstretched hand appeared to be wet with blood. He was gripped by déjà vu, absolutely convinced that he had once really stood under a scarlet moon, bathed in its bloody glow. Although he wanted to understand how this strange red light related to the wondrous golden light of his dreams, although he still felt himself being called by something unknown that waited in that radiance, he was suddenly afraid. As the scarlet beams intensified, as his room became a cauldron of heatless red fire and red shadows, his fear grew into terror of such power that it made him shake and sweat. He pulled his hand back, and the scarlet light rapidly faded to silver, and the silver dimmed as well until the circle of frost on the window shone with only a natural reflection of the January moon. As darkness laid claim to his room once more, Brendan sat up and hastily switched on the lamp. Damp with sweat, as full of the night shakes as any child frightened by fantasies of carnivorous goblins, he went to the window. The icy circle was still there, a moon image in the center of the otherwise unfrosted pane of glass. He had wondered if the light had been but a dream or hallucination. In a way, he almost wished it had been only that. But the frost moon was still there, proof that what he had seen was real, not a delusion. Hesitantly, he touched the glass. He felt nothing unusual, just the bitter cold of winter pressing against the other side of the pane. With a start, he realized that he felt the swollen rings in his palms. He turned his hands over and watched as the stigmata faded. He returned to bed. For a long while he sat with his back against the headboard, with his eyes open and the light on, waiting for the courage to lie down in darkness. Elko County, Nevada. Ernie stood by the tub in the bathroom, trying to recall precisely what he had thought and felt in the early hours of Saturday, December 14th, when he had been driven by some strange impulse to open the window and had suffered that frightening hallucination. The writer, Dominic Corvaces, stood by the sink, and Faye watched from the doorway. Reflections of the ceiling light and the light above the mirror imparted a warmth to the ceramic tile floor, glimmered in the chrome faucets and shower rod, gave a bright, flat sheen to the plastic shower curtain, and gradually illuminated the memories that Ernie sought.
Light. I came in here for the light. My fear of the dark was at a peak then, and I was trying to hide it from Faye. Couldn't sleep, so I slipped out of bed, came here, closed the door, and just sort of reveled in the light.
He told how his gaze was drawn to the window above the tub, and how he was overcome by an irrational and urgent need to escape.
It's hard to explain, but suddenly crazy thoughts whirled into my head. For some reason I panicked. I thought, this is my one chance to escape, so I'd better take it. Go through that window, head up into the hills, get to a ranch, get help.
Help for what? Corvaces asked. Why did you need help? Why did you feel you needed to escape from your own home? Ernie frowned.
Don't have the foggiest notion.
He remembered the way he had felt that night, the eeriness, urgency, strangely mixed with dreaminess. He pointed to the window.
I actually slid back the bolt, opened it. Might have crawled out, too, except I saw someone outside, on the roof of the utility room.
Who? Corvaces asked.
Sounds silly. It was a guy in motorcycle gear. White crash helmet. Dark visor over his face. Black gloves. In fact, he reached one hand through the window as if making a grab for me. And I stepped backward, fell over the edge of the tub.
That's when I came running, Faye said.
I got off the floor, Ernie said. Went back to the window, looked out on the roof. No one there. It had been just hallucination.
Faye said, in extreme cases of phobia, when the sufferer is in almost constant anxiety, hallucinations sometimes occur. The writer stared at the opaque window above the tub, as if hoping to find some vital secret revealed in the uneven, milky texture of the glass. At last he said,
it wasn't exactly a hallucination. I have a hunch that what you saw, Ernie, was a... well, call it a memory flash. From the summer before last, from the lost days. For a moment, back on December 14th, your repressed memory surged toward the surface. You had a flashback to a time when you really were a prisoner in your own home, when you really did try to escape.
And I was stopped by that guy on the roof of the utility room?
But what was he doing there in a motorcycle helmet?
Strange, isn't it?
Dom said. A man in a decontamination suit, sent to deal with a spill of chemicals or biological toxins, would wear an airtight helmet.
Decontamination. But if they were actually here in suits like that, then there must have really been a spill.
Maybe, Dom said. We still don't know enough to decide. Faye said, but listen, if we all went through this experience, like you think we did, then how come only you and Ernie and that Mr. Lomax are suffering repercussions? How come I'm not having bad dreams and psychological problems? The writer's gaze drifted back to the window.
I don't know. But those are some of the questions we've got to answer, if we've any hope of relieving the subconscious anxiety that this experience left in us, if we've any hope of getting on with normal lives.
Connecticut to New York City. After the money had been removed from the armored car, Jack and his men drove only 9 miles and parked the two phony Department of Highway vans in a four-stall rented garage leased with fake IDs where they had left their cars. The garage was one of a long row that faced both sides of a litter-strewn alley in a shabby neighborhood where relaxed zoning laws permitted intermingling of commercial and industrial facilities with residences. The area was characterized by peeling paint, grime, broken street lamps, empty storefronts, and mean-looking mongrel dogs on the loose. They emptied the contents of the canvas bags on the oily concrete floor of the garage and did a hasty count of the cash. They split it quickly into 5 shares of approximately $350,000 each, all in used bills that could never be traced. Jack felt no triumph, no thrill, nothing. In 5 minutes, the gang had dispersed like dandelion fluff on a brisk wind. Clockwork. As Jack headed home to Manhattan, spits of snow fell in brief squalls, though not enough to dust the highway or interfere with travel. During the drive from Connecticut, in a strange mood, he underwent a change he could not have anticipated. Minute by minute and mile by mile, the grayness in him began at last to be colored by emotion. His ennui gave way to feelings that surprised him. He would not have been surprised by a new welling up of grief or loneliness, for Jenny had been dead only 17 days. But the emotion that steadily tightened its grip on him was guilt. The stolen money in the trunk of the car began to weigh on his conscience as heavily as if it were the first ill-gotten goods ever to fall into his hands. Through 8 busy years of meticulously planned and triumphantly executed larcenies, several on an even grander scale than the armored car, he had never experienced the mildest quiver of guilt. Until now. He had seen himself as a just avenger. until now. Cruising to Manhattan through the blustery winter night, he began to see himself as little more than a common thief. Guilt wrapped him like flypaper. He tried repeatedly to shake it off. It clung. Sudden as it seemed, the guilt had actually been building for a long time. That was where his growing dissatisfaction had been leading for months. Disillusionment had set in noticeably with the jewelry store job last October, and he'd thought the changes had begun then. But now, forced into self-analysis, he realized he had stopped getting a full measure of pleasure from his work long ago. As he scrolled backward in his memory, seeking the most recent job that had left him fulfilled, he was startled to discover it was the McAllister burglary in Marin County, north of San Francisco, the summer before last. Ordinarily, he worked only in the east, near Jenny, but Branch Pollard, with whom he had pulled off the just-completed Guardmaster heist, had settled in California for a while, and during that Pacific sojourn he had spotted Averill McAllister, a sheep waiting to be sheared. McAllister, an industrialist worth $200 million, lived on an 8-acre estate in Marin County, protected by stone walls, a complex electronic security system, and guard dogs. With information developed from a half-dozen sources, Branch had determined that McAllister was a collector of rare stamps and coins, two eminently fencible commodities. Besides, the industrialist was a gambler who went to Vegas 3 times a year, usually dropping $250,000 each visit, but sometimes winning big. He always took his winnings in cash to avoid the tax man, and some of that cash was surely in the mansion. Branch needed Jack's sense of strategy and expertise in electronics, and Jack needed a change of scenery, so they pulled it off with the help of a third man. After considerable planning, getting on to the estate and into the house went smoothly. They were prepared with an electronic listening device that could detect the soft tick of a safe's tumblers and amplify them, which made deducing the combination mere child's play. But as insurance, they also took a full set of safe-cracking tools and a plastic explosive. The problem was that Averill McAllister had no mere safe. He had a damn vault. The industrialist was so certain of the vault door's inviolability that he'd made no effort to conceal it with a sliding partition or tapestry. It was in one wall of the immense game room, a massive stainless steel portal as big as anything in a first-class bank. The listening device Jack had brought was not sensitive enough to detect the movement of tumblers through 20 inches of stainless steel. The plastic explosive would have peeled any safe, but the vault was blast-proof. The set of safecracker's tools was a joke. They left the estate with no stamps or coins, but with sterling silver, a complete collection of Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett first editions, a few jewels that Mrs. McAllister carelessly left out of the vault, and a handful of other items, which they fenced for only $60,000, split three ways. The take was by no means a pittance, but it was far less than anticipated, insufficient to cover their expenses and to make their time, planning, and risks worthwhile. In spite of this debacle, Jack had gotten a kick out of the job. Once they had safely fled the McAllister estate, he and Branch had seen the humor in the catastrophe and had been able to laugh about it. They spent 2 days relaxing in the California sun. Then, on a whim, Jack took his $20,000 to Reno to see if he could do better at craps and blackjack than he had done at burglary. 24 hours after checking into Harris, he checked out, the $20,000 having grown to an amazing $107,455. The exquisite symmetry of bad luck money bringing good luck was enormously appealing. Deciding to extend his vacation, he rented a car and drove back to New York, all the way across the country, in a splendid mood, eager to see Jenny. Now, more than 18 months later, as he entered Manhattan on his return trip from Connecticut, Jack realized that, curiously, The fiasco at the McAllister estate had been the last enterprise to provide untainted satisfaction. At that point he had begun a long journey from dead-end amorality all the way across the moral spectrum until he had become once more capable of guilt. But why? What had initiated the change in him? What continued to power it? He had no answers. All he knew was that he was no longer able to think of himself as a melancholy and romantic bandit with a just mission to redress the wrongs done to him and to his beloved wife. He was merely a thief. For 8 years, he had been deluding himself. Now he saw himself for what he really was, and the sudden insight was devastating. He had not merely become a man without purpose. Worse, without realizing it, he had been lacking a worthwhile purpose for 8 years. He drove aimlessly through the streets of Manhattan, going nowhere in particular, unwilling to return straight away to the apartment. He soon found himself on Fifth Avenue, approaching St. Patrick's, and on impulse he pulled to the curb, parked illegally before the main doors of the immense cathedral. He got out of the car, went around to the trunk, opened it, and pulled half a dozen banded stacks of $20 bills from the plastic garbage bag. It was foolhardy to leave the car illegally parked in so prominent a location when its trunk contained more than a third of $1 million in stolen money, an illegally obtained device like slicks and guns. If a cop stopped to give him a ticket and became suspicious and demanded to search the car, Jack would be finished. But he had ceased to care. In some ways, he was a dead man who still walked, just as Jenny had been a dead woman who still breathed. Though not a Catholic, he pulled open one of the sculpted bronze doors of St. Patrick's, went inside into the nave, where a handful of people knelt in the front pews, praying or saying the rosary, and where an old man was lighting a votive candle even at this hour. Jack stood for a moment looking up at the elegant baldachin above the main altar. Then he located the poor boxes, removed the bundles of $20 bills from inside his winter jacket, broke the paper bands that bound them, and stuffed the money into the containers as if he were jamming garbage into trash receptacles. Outside again, as he was descending the granite steps, he stopped abruptly and blinked at the night-draped cityscape, for something was different about Fifth Avenue. As a few huge snowflakes spiraled lazily through the glow of street lamps and through the lights of cars moving along the thoroughfare, Jack gradually realized the city had reacquired a fraction of the glitter, glamour, and mystery that it always had for him before he'd gone to Central America, but which it had not possessed in ages. It seemed cleaner now than it had been in a long time, and the air was crisper, less polluted. Staring around in amazement, he slowly understood that the city had not undergone a metamorphosis during the past few minutes. It was the same city that it had been an hour ago, and yesterday. But when he had come back from Central America, he had been a different man from the one who had gone away, and on returning he had been unable to see anything good in the metropolis or in any other works of the society he hated. Much of the Big Apple's dreariness and degeneration had been merely a reflection of his own blasted, burnt-out, corrupted inner landscape. Jack returned to the Camaro, went west to Sixth Avenue, north to Central Park, made a right turn, then another right onto Fifth Avenue again, heading south, not sure where he was going, until he reached the Fifth Avenue Presbyterian Church. Once more, he parked illegally, took cash from the trunk, and went into the church. There was no poor box, as in St. Patrick's, but Jack found a young assistant minister in the process of closing the place for the night. From various pockets, Jack produced bundles of $10 and $20 bills wrapped with rubber bands and handed them to the startled cleric, claiming to have won a fortune in the casinos of Atlantic City. In two stops, he had given away $30,000, but that was not even one-tenth of what he had brought back from Connecticut,
and those dispensations did not allay his guilt. In fact, his newfound shame was growing stronger by the minute. The bag of money in the trunk was to him like the telltale heart buried under the floorboards in the story by Poe, a throbbing annunciator of his guilt, and he was as anxious to be rid of it as Poe's narrator had been anxious to silence the incriminating heartbeat of his dismembered victim. $330,000 remained. For some New Yorkers, Christmas was about to come 2.5 weeks late. Elko County, Nevada. The summer before last, Dom had stayed in room 20. He remembered it well because it was the last unit in the motel's L-shaped east wing. Ernie Block's curiosity was more compelling than his nyctophobia, so he decided to accompany Fay and Dom to room 20, where it was hoped that Dom's memories would be stirred by the sight of the familiar walls and furnishings. Ernie walked between Fay and Dom, who held his arms. During the trip along the breezeway, the frigid night wind made Dom glad for his fleece-lined jacket. More concerned about the black night than the chill, Ernie kept his eyes shut for the entire journey. Fay went in first, snapping on the light's closing drapes. Dom followed with Ernie, who opened his eyes only when Fay shut the door. Upon entering the room, Dom was filled with apprehension. He walked to the queen-sized bed, stared down at it. He tried to remember lying here, drugged and helpless. Fay said,
"The bedspread's not the same, of course."
The Polaroid had shown the corner of a floral-patterned spread. The current model was brown and blue striped.
"The bed itself is the same, and all the furniture," Ernie said.
The padded headboard was upholstered with a coarse brown fabric, slightly snagged and worn. The nightstands were plain two-drawer chests with laminated walnut veneer. The bases of the lamps resembled large hurricane lanterns, black metal with two panes of smoky amber glass in each side. The cloth shades were the same amber hue as the glass in the base. Each lamp had two bulbs. The main one, under the shade, provided most of the light. The second bulb, inside the base, was shaped like a candle flame and gave off a dim, flickering glow that imitated a real flame and was used only for its decorative effect, to enhance the illusion of hurricane lanterns. Dom remembered every detail of the place now that he was standing in it, and he had the impression that a multitude of ghosts flitted teasingly through the room, staying just at the periphery of his vision. The ghosts were actually bad memories rather than spirits, and they haunted not the room, but the shadowy corners of his own mind.
"Remember anything?" Ernie asked. "Is it coming back to you?"
"I want to have a look at the John," Dom said. It was small and strictly functional, with a shower stall but no bathtub, a speckled tile floor, and durable formica countertops.
Dom was interested in the sink, for it was surely the one in his recurring nightmare. But when he looked into the bowl, he was surprised to see a mechanical stopper, and an inch below the rim of the bowl, the overflow drain consisted of three round holes, a more modern design than the six slanted lozenge-shaped outlets in the sink of his dreams.
"This isn't the same," he said. "The sink was old, with a rubber stopper attached to a bead chain and hung from the cold water faucet."
"We're always upgrading the place," Ernie said from the doorway.
"We took that sink out 8 or 9 months ago," Fay said. "We replaced the formica then, too, although it's the same color as before."
Dom was disappointed, because he had been convinced that at least some memories from those lost days would begin to return to him when he touched the sink. After all, judging from the stark terror of the nightmare, something particularly frightening had happened to him at that very spot. Therefore, it seemed likely that the sink might act as a lightning rod upon the supercharged memories that drifted in the darkness of his subconscious, drawing them back in a sudden, crackling blaze of recollection. He put his hands on the new sink, but he felt only cold porcelain.
"Anything?"
Ernie asked again.
"No," Dom said. "No memories, but bad vibrations.
If I give it time, I think the room might break down the barriers. I'll sleep here tonight, give it a chance to work on me, if that's all right.
No problem, Faye said. The room's yours.
Dom said, I have a hunch the nightmare will be worse here than it's ever been before.
Laguna Beach, California. Although Parker Fane was one of the most respected of living American artists, although his canvases were assiduously collected by major museums, although he had been commissioned to create works for the President of the United States and other luminaries, he was not too old, and certainly not too dignified, to get a thrill from the intrigue upon which he was engaged in Dominic Corvaces's behalf. To be a successful artist, one needed maturity, an adult's perception and sensitivity, and dedication to craftsmanship, but one also had to hold on to a child's curiosity, wonder, innocence, and sense of fun. Parker held tighter to those things than most artists did. Therefore, he fulfilled his role in Dom's plans with a spirit of adventure. Each day, when he picked up Dom's mail, Parker pretended to go about his business without the slightest suspicion that he might be under surveillance. But in fact, he searched surreptitiously, diligently, for the watchers, spies, cops, or whatever they might be. He never saw anyone observing him, and he never detected a tail. And each night, when he left his house and went to a different payphone to await Dom's prearranged call, he drove miles out of his way, turned back on his own route, made sudden turns calculated to throw off a tail until he was sure that he was not being followed. A few minutes before 9 o'clock, Saturday night, he arrived by his usual devious means at a telephone booth beside a Union 76 station. A hard rain fell, sluicing down the plexiglass walls, distorting the world beyond and screening Parker from prying eyes. He was wearing a trench coat and a rainproof khaki hat with the rim turned down all the way around to let the rain run off. He felt as if he belonged in a Jean Le Carré tale. He loved it. Promptly at 9 o'clock, the phone rang. It was Dom.
I'm on schedule at the Tranquility Motel. This is the place, Parker.
Dom had a lot to tell. A disturbing experience in the Tranquility Grill, Ernie Block's nyctophobia, and by indirection he managed to convey that the Blocks had received strange Polaroid snapshots, too. Discretion was essential. If the Tranquility Motel was indeed the center of the unremembered events of the summer before last, the Blocks' phones might be tapped. If the listeners heard about the photographs, they would know they had a traitor in their midst, and they would surely find him, and there would be no more notes or photos forthcoming.
I've got news, too, Parker said. Ms. Wycombe, your editor, left a message on your answering machine. Twilight and Babylon had another printing, and there are now 100,000 copies in the stores.
Good God! I'd forgotten the book. Since Lomax House 4 days ago, I haven't thought about anything but this crazy situation.
Ms. Wycombe has more good news she wants to share, so you're to call her as soon as you get a chance.
I'll do that. Meanwhile, seen any interesting pictures?
Dom asked, indirectly inquiring if any more Polaroids had been received.
Nope. No amusing notes, either.
When the headlights of passing cars swept across the booth, the thin skin of flowing water on the transparent walls flared briefly with a rippling, shimmering brilliance. Parker said,
But something came in the mail that'll knock your socks off, buddy. You've identified 3 of the names on those moon posters at Lomax. So how'd you like to hear who the 4th one is?
Ginger? I forgot to tell you. I think her name's on the motel registry. Dr. Ginger Weiss of Boston. I intend to call her tomorrow.
Well, you've stolen some of my thunder. But you'll be surprised to hear you got a letter today from Dr. Weiss. She sent it to Random House on December 26th, but it got caught in their bureaucracy. Anyway, she's at the end of her rope, see? And then she gets hold of a copy of your book, gloms your photo, and she gets this feeling she's met you before and that you are a part of what's been happening to her. Do you have the letter with you?
Dom asked excitedly. Parker had it in his hand, waiting. He read it, glancing now and then at the night beyond the booth.
"I've got to call her right away," Dom said when Parker finished the letter. "Can't wait till morning now. I'll talk to you again tomorrow night, 9 o'clock. If you'll be calling from the motel where the phones are likely to be tapped, there's no point in my running out to a phone booth."
"You're right. I'll call you at home."
"Take care," Dom said. "You too."
With mixed feelings, Parker put the receiver on the hook, relieved that these inconvenient nightly journeys to a payphone were at an end, but also certain that he would miss the intrigue. He stepped out of the phone booth into the rain, and he was almost disappointed when no one took a shot at him. Boston, Massachusetts. Pablo Jackson had been buried that morning, but he was with Ginger Weiss throughout the afternoon and evening. Like a ghost, his memory haunted her, a smiling revenant in the chambers of her mind. Keeping to herself in the guest room at Baywatch, she tried to read, could not concentrate. When not preoccupied with memories of the old magician, she was eaten up by worry, wondering what would become of her. She got into bed at 12:15 and was reaching for the switch to turn off the lamp when Rita Hannaby came to tell her that Dominic Corbasis was on the phone and that she could take the call in George's study down the hall adjacent to the master bedroom. Excited and trepidatious, Ginger put on a robe over her pajamas. The study was warm and shadowy with dark oak paneling. The Chinese carpet was beige and forest green, and the stained glass lamp on the desk was either a genuine Tiffany or a superb reproduction. George's puffy eyes made it clear that the call woke him. He began surgery early most mornings and was usually in bed by 9:30.
"I'm sorry," Ginger told him.
"No need," George said. "Isn't this what we've been hoping for?"
"Maybe," she said, unwilling to raise her hopes.
Rita said, "We'll give you privacy."
"No," Ginger said. "Stay. Please."
She went to the desk, sat down, picked up the uncradled handset.
"Hello. Mr. Corvasis?"
"Dr. Weiss?"
His voice was strong yet melodic. "Writing to me was the best thing you could have done. I don't think you're nuts. Because you're not alone, Doctor. There are more of us with strange problems."
Ginger tried to respond, but her voice cracked. She cleared her throat.
"I'm sorry. I don't usually cry."
Corbasis said, "Don't try to talk until you're ready. I'll tell you about my problem, sleepwalking, and my dreams about the moon."
A thrill, half cold fear and half exultation, throbbed through her.
"The moon," she agreed. "I never remember the dreams, but they must involve the moon because that's what I wake up screaming about."
He told her about a man named Lomac in Reno, dead by his own hand, driven to suicide by an obsession with the moon. Ginger sensed some vast gulf beneath her, a fearful unknown.
"We've been brainwashed," she blurted. "All these problems we're having are the result of repressed memories trying to surface."
For a moment there was a stunned silence on the line. Then the writer said,
"That's been my theory, but you sound sure of it."
"I am. I underwent hypnotic regression therapy after I wrote to you, and we turned up evidence of systematic memory repression."
"Something happened to us the summer before last," he said.
"Yes, the summer before last. The Tranquility Motel in Nevada."
"That's where I'm calling from."
Startled, she said,
"You're there now?"
"Yes, and if possible, you ought to come. A lot has happened that I can't risk talking about on the phone."
"Who are they?" she asked in frustration. "What are they hiding?"
"We'll have a better chance finding out if we all work together."
"I'll come, tomorrow, if I can book a flight that quickly."
Rita started to protest that Ginger was in no condition to travel. In the many-colored light of the Tiffany lamp, George's scowl deepened. To Corvasis, Ginger said,
"I'll let you know how and when I'll arrive."
When Ginger hung up, George said, "You can't possibly go all that way in your condition."
Rita said, "What if you black out on the airplane, become violent?"
I'll be all right. Dear, you had 3 seizures last Monday, one after the other.
Ginger sighed and slumped back in the green leather chair.
Rita, George, you've been wonderful to me, and I can never adequately repay you. I love you, I really do. But I've been living with you for 5 weeks, 5 helpless weeks, during which I've been more like a dependent child than an adult, and I'm just not capable of going on that way. I've got to go to Nevada. I've no other option. I've got to.
New York, New York. A couple of blocks farther down Fifth Avenue from the Presbyterian Church, Jack stopped again in front of St. Thomas's Episcopal Church. In the nave, he stared in fascination at the huge reredos of Dunville stone behind the altar. He met the strangely portentous gazes of the statues in the shadowy niches along the walls, saints, apostles, the Blessed Virgin, Christ, and he realized that the primary purpose of religion was the expiation of guilt, to provide people with forgiveness for being less than they were meant to be. The human species seemed incapable of living up to its potential, and some would be driven mad by guilt if they did not believe that a God, be it Jesus, Yahweh, Muhammad, Marx, or some other, looked on them with favor in spite of themselves. But Jack found no comfort in St. Thomas's, no expiation of his sins, not even when he left $20,000 in the charity box. In the Camaro again, he set out to dispose of the rest of the cash from the Guardmaster heist, not because giving it away would salve his guilt. It would not, for redistribution of the funds was not the moral equivalent of repayment. He had too much to atone for to expect to shrive himself of all his transgressions in one night. But he did not need or want the money any more, could not simply throw it in the trash, so giving the damn stuff away was his only possible course of action. He stopped at more churches and temples, some were open, some locked. Where he could gain entrance, he left money. He drove down to the Bowery and left $40,000 with the startled night attendant at the Salvation Army mission. On Bayard Street in nearby Chinatown, Jack saw a sign in a second-floor window that proclaimed, in both Chinese characters and in English, the Alliance Against Oppression of Chinese Minorities. The place was above a quaint apothecary that specialized in the herbs and powdered roots of traditional Chinese medicines. The apothecary was closed, but a light shone in a window of the Alliance offices. Jack rang the bell at the street-level door, rang it and rang it, until an elderly and wizened Chinese man came down the stairs and spoke to him through a small grill. When Jack ascertained that the Alliance's current major project was the rescue of brutalized Chinese families from Vietnam and resettlement in the States, he passed $20,000 in cash through the grill. The Chinese gentleman reverted to his native